In 1970, a Japanese biochemist by the name of Satoshi Omura discovered a bacterium that had intriguing effects against roundworm. He shared his discovery with his American colleague, William Campbell, who worked for Merck Pharmaceuticals. Campbell used the bacterium to create a medicine called ivermectin, which was released by Merck in 1980. Ivermectin was found to be extremely effective against a disease called onchocerciasis, which is better known as river blindness. River blindness is caused by a parasitic worm, and it has caused untold suffering and even death in parts of Central and South America and much of Africa. With the use of ivermectin, river blindness has been largely eliminated in the Americas and greatly reduced in Africa. Billions of doses of the drug have been administered, and it's listed as one of the World Health Organization's essential medicines. Merck's patent on ivermectin expired in 1996. The drug is extremely cheap to produce, and it's available all over the world in a variety of formulations. Best of all, it's extremely safe. At normal dosages, it has no important side effects. In 2015, in recognition of his contributions, Dr. Omura was given the Nobel Prize for Medicine, which he shared with Dr. Campbell. Fast forward to early 2020, when the COVID pandemic was spreading around the world. Scientists and doctors were searching frantically for drugs that could treat the disease. The obvious place to start was with existing drugs that had shown antiviral activity. Early in the year, a team of scientists working at Australia's Monash University did a literature search and discovered that ivermectin had shown activity against such viruses as Zika, West Nile, and influenza. They performed a series of experiments in which they found that ivermectin displays remarkable activity against SARS-CoV-2 in vitro, which is to say, in test tubes. They published their results in a paper that appeared in April of 2020. They found that a single treatment with ivermectin produces a 5,000-fold reduction in viral levels without any cytotoxicity, meaning it didn't harm the cells. Along with their results, they proposed a mechanism whereby ivermectin achieves this miraculous effect. Around the same time, a pair of scientists working in the United States realized that ivermectin was being widely used as a prophylaxis against river blindness in Africa. They wondered if the use of ivermectin would have any effect on rates of COVID-19. They looked at countries where ivermectin was administered to entire populations and compared their rates of COVID-19 to countries where they had no such program. They found that countries that had widespread ivermectin prophylaxis had significantly lower rates of COVID-19. Meanwhile, doctors in hospitals around the world were dealing with an onslaught of patients with COVID-19, and they had no good medicines to treat the disease. One such doctor was Jean-Jacques Reiter, a critical care and pulmonary specialist working at Broward Health Medical Center, the largest hospital in Miami-Dade County. Being a lung specialist working in the ICU, Dr. Reiter was truly on the front lines of the war against COVID. One day, he found himself talking to the son of an elderly woman who was doing very poorly in her fight against COVID in the ICU. Keep in mind that this was at a time in the pandemic when those who were dying of COVID were not even allowed to visit with their loved ones before they passed. They often had to say their final words via telephone. Let's let Dr. Reiter tell the story from here.
I called the patient's son up and said, listen, you may want to call mom. Mom's deteriorating rapidly. She's likely going to end up on a ventilator. So talk to her now. So we went back and forth. It's like, doctor, there is something else. There must be something else. I'm like, no, sir, I have nothing. Nobody has anything.
But luckily for this patient, this man was not going to give up so easily. And he pushed Dr. Reiter to think of a treatment.
I tell him, listen, there is this one study that I reviewed 2 days ago in test tubes, in vitro, about the use of ivermectin. He was like, okay, so let's do it. Okay. So she got ivermectin. Within 48 hours, her FiO2 requirements were coming down again. And probably within a week or so, she was discharged to home.
Dr. Reiter went on to treat a series of COVID patients with ivermectin, and he published the results in a preprint paper which appeared in June of 2020. Later in 2020, he testified before a Senate committee about his experiences treating COVID patients with ivermectin.
Of the hundreds of outpatient treated by my team, only two, I repeat, two were admitted to the hospital. Neither one of them died. Neither one of them needed intubation.
At the same time, all around the world, a number of unintended controlled studies on the use of ivermectin to prevent COVID-19 were being carried out. One such study took place at the Valley View Care Home in North York, Ontario, Canada. A daughter of one of the residents of the care home reported her experience on the YouTube channel of Dr. Jennifer Hibbard. Her mother lived on the fourth floor of the care home, which experienced a scabies outbreak in March of 2020. The residents of that floor were treated with ivermectin, which eliminates scabies. Residents of other floors were given smaller doses of ivermectin to prevent scabies. The staff of the care home were not given ivermectin, and many of them tested positive for COVID-19 when the pandemic swept Ontario in the spring. Despite the staff coming into constant contact with the residents, here's what happened.
On the fourth floor, which is the floor that had the scabies outbreak, and they received the highest dose, had the most infected staff, and not one single resident was infected with COVID.
As anecdotal reports and studies like these started to pile up, they caught the attention of doctors working on the front lines against COVID. One such doctor was Pierre Corey, a pulmonologist and ICU specialist working at New York's prestigious Mount Sinai Beth Israel Hospital. New York suffered one of the worst outbreaks of COVID in the entire world. So a pulmonologist working in the ICU of a hospital in that city probably had a closer view of COVID-19 than almost any other doctor on earth. In the spring of 2020, Dr. Corey teamed up with Dr. Reiter and Dr. Paul Marek to form the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance, or FLCCC. In October of 2020, the FLCCC released the iMask Plus protocol, a protocol which centers on the use of ivermectin for preventing and treating COVID-19. In early November of 2020, the FLCCC released a paper in which they reviewed the studies on the use of ivermectin as a prophylaxis and treatment for COVID-19. This paper was a meta-analysis. A meta-analysis is a study which looks at many other studies and analyzes their results. They found that ivermectin was extremely effective in both preventing and treating COVID-19. Here are the findings of 9 studies on the use of ivermectin as a prophylaxis against COVID-19. In this figure, anything to the left of 1 indicates that ivermectin is more effective than the control. Here's a figure from the FLCCC showing the effect of the introduction of ivermectin on daily death rates in various states in the country of Peru. As you can see, the introduction of ivermectin resulted in an immediate and sustained decrease in COVID-19 mortality. Likewise, here's a figure showing COVID-19 case rates in the various states of Mexico. The southern state of Chiapas was the only Mexican state to widely distribute ivermectin. Note the huge reduction in COVID-19 cases and compare it to neighboring states. The paper also discusses a study conducted in Argentina where a large group of healthcare workers was given ivermectin. Of the 788 workers who were given ivermectin, none of them contracted COVID, whereas over 50% of the controls who weren't given ivermectin did contract COVID. The FLCCC paper also looked at 12 studies of the use of ivermectin to treat people who had been infected with SARS-CoV-2. All 12 studies, including 7 randomized control studies, showed that ivermectin was superior to the control. On December 8th of 2020, members of the FLCCC appeared before a Senate subcommittee on the early treatment of COVID-19, which was chaired by Senator Ron Johnson. Here's some of Dr. Corey's testimony to the committee.
Mountains of data have emerged from many centers and countries around the world showing the miraculous effectiveness of ivermectin. It basically obliterates transmission of this virus. If you take it, you will not get sick. I cannot keep caring for patients when I know that they could have been saved with earlier treatment and that drug that will treat them and prevent the hospitalization is ivermectin. All I ask is for the NIH to review our data that we've compiled of all of the emerging data. We have almost 30 studies. Everyone is reliably and reproducibly positive, showing the dramatic impacts of ivermectin.
Now, given all the deaths and economic destruction caused by COVID-19, you would think that the government and the health agencies and the media of the United States would have welcomed this news with open arms. But that's not what happened. Instead, a coalition of powerful forces acted together to completely suppress any information on the effectiveness of ivermectin in treating and preventing COVID-19. So now, let's take a close look at who suppressed ivermectin. The first big player to suppress ivermectin was the mainstream media. The New York Times led the way by declaring that the Senate hearing had promoted unproven drugs and dubious claims. AP followed with an astonishing claim that there's no evidence that ivermectin works against COVID-19, conveniently ignoring every single one of the studies that was listed in the FLCCC paper. The next group to suppress ivermectin was big tech. YouTube, which is owned by Google, censored a popular video by Dr. Chris Martinson on ivermectin. They did the same to Dr. Christy Reisinger.
To my shock and dismay, the previous video I published on December 22nd about ivermectin was taken down by YouTube.
Twitter went as far as blacklisting a European medical journal that published an article on treating COVID-19 with ivermectin. Facebook went even further and removed posts by the FLCCC about their paper. The next major group to suppress ivermectin was the NIH, America's National Institutes of Health. In April of 2020, the NIH formed the COVID-19 Treatment Guidelines Panel. This panel was incredibly influential because essentially they decided what treatment doctors in the United States could use to treat patients with COVID-19. Here are the panel's treatment recommendations from January 3, 2021, taken from their website. These were in place for most of 2020. Take a close look at the recommendations for people who are COVID positive but not yet in the hospital, or in the hospital but not yet requiring oxygen supplementation. They say that a doctor can apply for an EUA, or emergency use authorization, for a monoclonal antibody, a very troublesome process, but they recommend no other treatments. This approach to treating early COVID has been described as therapeutic nihilism by Dr. Paul Marek. Leaving aside ivermectin for the moment, this is truly shocking, especially given what we know about the efficacy of things like vitamin D in preventing COVID from progressing to more severe stages. And preventing that progression is paramount, because there's a point of no return for many patients with COVID. Once they cross it and require intubation, they often cannot be saved. So just think about this policy for a second. The NIH COVID-19 treatment panel is saying, do not treat your patients until they are so sick that they need to be put on supplemental oxygen. They only make a definitive drug recommendation for patients who have deteriorated to the point where they will not survive without supplemental oxygen. And once they are that sick, what treatment do they recommend? They recommend a drug called remdesivir. It's almost as if the treatment guidelines are designed to get the patients to the point where they can be treated with remdesivir. Let's take a closer look at remdesivir. Most people first heard of remdesivir when Dr. Anthony Fauci made the unusual move of announcing it at a White House press conference in April 2020. Fauci is the head of the NIAID, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which is a department of the NIH. Here's Dr. Fauci speaking about remdesivir at the White House. Listen carefully to what he says about the endpoint of the study he's referring to.
The data shows that remdesivir has a clear-cut, significant, positive effect in diminishing the time to recovery.
Note that he doesn't say anything about mortality. He talks about diminishing the time to recovery. It's essential to note that Dr. Fauci's NIAID actually paid for the study he's referring to. So basically, Dr. Fauci can hardly be called an impartial judge of that study. And just as importantly, Dr. Fauci would have been well aware of the developments with the study as it was performed. He would have been well aware of the fact that midway through the trial, the primary endpoint was changed from mortality to time to recovery. And this was obviously because the researchers were seeing that remdesivir had no significant impact on mortality. Changing endpoints midway through a study is highly unusual. And many scientific commentators raised concerns about this. And yet Dr. Fauci, knowing that remdesivir did nothing to reduce mortality in COVID-19, pressed on, touting the drug as a remarkable advance in the treatment of COVID.
But we think it's really opening the door to the fact that we now have the capability of treating, and I can guarantee you, as more people, more companies, more investigators get involved, it's going to get better and better.
Not very long after Anthony Fauci made that statement, the World Health Organization recommended against the use of remdesivir. Based on much larger studies, they said there is no evidence that remdesivir improves survival or any other metric in COVID-19. Despite that, the NIH treatment panel continued to recommend remdesivir and continues to do so today. Now all of this begs the question, why would the NIH and Dr. Fauci continue to recommend a drug that has repeatedly been shown to have no effect on improving COVID-19 survival, and which costs over $3,100 per course, unlike ivermectin, which is nearly free? In order to answer that question, we have to look at who makes remdesivir and how they're related to the people who decide what drugs can be used to treat COVID-19. Remdesivir is made by Gilead Sciences, a pharmaceutical company located in Foster City, California. Gilead is an interesting company. From 1997 to 2001, the chairman of Gilead Sciences was Donald Rumsfeld, one of the architects of the invasion of Iraq. During the same period, one of the board members of Gilead was George Shultz, a longtime Bush family ally who was instrumental in convincing George W. Bush to run for president of the United States. In order to understand why the NIH treatment panel is so pro-remdesivir, it's essential to understand the financial ties between Gilead Sciences and members of that treatment panel. If you look at the treatment panel's financial disclosures, you will see that no fewer than 7 members disclose financial support from Gilead Sciences. Interestingly, the 3 co-chairs who select the other members of the panel do not disclose support from Gilead. However, 2 of the chairs, Roy Gulick and Henry Masor, both receive financial support from Gilead. Even more interestingly, the 3rd co-chair, Clifford Lane, was actually one of the authors of the NIAID study on remdesivir. But you won't see his name in the list of the article's authors. You have to look in the financial disclosure form that accompanied that article. It's also worth noting that 7 out of 12 of his co-authors on that study disclosed funding from Gilead Sciences. The significance of this cannot be overstated. 2 of the 3 chairs of the NIH COVID-19 treatment panel, the people who put the panel together, received financial support from Gilead Sciences, while the other was intimately involved in the study that attempted and failed to prove that remdesivir was an effective treatment for COVID-19. Given these professional and financial ties, is there any way we could reasonably expect them to impartially judge the best treatments for COVID-19 or choose panel members who might advocate for repurposing cheap, off-patent drugs that would completely undercut the market for one of the main products of a company with which they enjoy close financial and professional ties? It's not necessary for any of them to have said, let's not promote cheap drugs and promote remdesivir instead. Financial and research interests had already corrupted their decision-making processes and biases. But we should be clear. There are sins of omission and sins of commission. And there's no way that the members of the panel, at least some of them, were unaware of the research concerning ivermectin. And yet, no one chose to bring that to the fore in their meetings. Rather than recommend ivermectin, or at least recommend more studies into ivermectin, they chose to continue to push the drug remdesivir, which they knew had no discernible effect on COVID-19 survival. This is professional negligence of the worst sort, and given the disproportionate influence that America's medical agencies have on many other countries' medical agencies, it's very likely that their negligence resulted in hundreds of thousands or even millions of deaths around the world. And let us be completely clear about why they chose to suppress ivermectin and push a drug that they knew didn't work. They did it so that one pharmaceutical company with deep political connections, huge media support, and big tech backing could make obscene profits for themselves and their shareholders. Now let's imagine, just as a thought exercise, what if the NIH and Dr. Anthony Fauci had been doing their jobs? What if, sometime in the summer of 2020, they had authorized doctors across the country to use ivermectin at their discretion? It's actually not that hard to figure out what would have happened, because there is a place, with a population almost the size of the United States, where that's exactly what the health authorities did. The state of Uttar Pradesh in India has a population about 70% the size of the United States. In August of 2020, the Uttar Pradesh state government authorized the use of ivermectin as a prophylaxis and treatment for COVID-19. It was given to those who tested positive for COVID, as well as their primary contacts and healthcare workers. Let's look at the stats for COVID-19 mortality in Uttar Pradesh. There was a peak of mortality in the summer, but deaths dropped very quickly after that. As we get into January of 2021, we see that deaths are averaging fewer than 10 a day. And on January 19th, in a state with 230 million people, exactly no one died from COVID-19. While in the United States, a country with a much more expensive medical system, we're averaging over 3,000 deaths per day. We know who the villains are in this story. But who are the victims? If you've lost a friend or a family member to COVID-19, you are a victim. If your children's education or socialization has been disrupted by COVID-19, you are a victim. If you've lost your job or your business because of COVID-19, you are a victim. If you are suffering from long COVID and you don't know when or if you will get better, you are a victim. If you're elderly and you are aware that time is limited and yet you cannot meet with your children or grandchildren, you are a victim. It is now clear that big tech and the mainstream media worked with the NIH to suppress knowledge of a drug that could have ended the pandemic last summer. This is not mere professional negligence. This is a crime.